Welcome on to a massive Tuesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. This game five between Oklahoma City and San Antonio could be one of those games that we look back on as a game that basically changed so much of the future of the league. If, in fact, Oklahoma City does go on to win this one, just a huge upset on the road. We are going to spend all kinds of time breaking down exactly how this epic game unfolded, and joining me to do so is Danny LaRue.
It was surreal to me at the time just because I thought I had a sense of kind of where this series was going, but it is true that the Spurs have lost games like this in their past.
Yeah, you know, you're right about that, and I think that for whatever reason, just because the Spurs have always been this sort of enormous monolith, the Spurs Borg, as some, I think Zach Lowe in particular, has called them at times, that they're sort of viewed as like infallible in close games and this great clutch team that's just always going to out-execute you, and you better not get into a close game with these guys. But if you really think about it, going back through their history, when they win in blowouts. And usually when it's close, it's hard to really point to these kind of great close Spurs playoff wins. Maybe you could say 2014 Game 6 in overtime in Oklahoma City when Tony Parker went out. Like, that's really the only one that you can kind of point to for a long time in this Spurs era. Maybe in some of those games in 2007 against the Suns would be where you'd have to go back to. But a lot of times, they, you know, when they win, it's in blowouts. And a lot of these Spurs losses are kind of close games where they've had some crunch time foibles, and they had some tonight.
And there was a moment in this game that we'll talk about that evoked when Manu fouled Dirk Nowitzki in the Western Conference Finals. Was that 05?
06 was when that was. Yeah, when they lost at home. I mean, and it's interesting, too. I mean, first of all, it's not to make the mistake that, like, fait accompli, the series is over.
Oh, of course.
It kind of feels that way in some ways, but, you know, all these last four games have all been totally close going down the end.
And both teams have won on the other team's home court, so.
Yeah. Yeah, so let's not say that, like, the Spurs are incapable of winning. I do think that the Thunder are clearly favorites in the series now. But, I think the Spurs have this history of these unbelievable teams losing, whether it was 2004 when they were the number one seed, 2006 might have even been their best ever regular season team before this year. They're the number one seed in 2011. They lost in the first round. 2012, they had won 20 games in a row. They lost to Oklahoma City. And then this game, obviously, you know, the best Spurs regular season team of all, one of the best defenses ever, if they hadn't kind of tanked it in on the last, two, 3 weeks of the season and not played their guys, they might have ended up with the best point differential ever by any team. And now they're staring elimination in the face.
And that isn't to say that, you know, that they're some sort of massive disappointment or they collapse, but it is notable in that sense. And this game illustrated some of the fundamental flaws with this team that, as great as they are, were always going to be a problem when you separate the wheat from the chaff and are only facing the best teams.
Maybe so. I think that we're probably even being too harsh on them to even say that they have fundamental flaws, a team that, you know, in any other year would have been, you know, by far the best team in the NBA were it not for Golden State. But they did have some issues. I mean, and I think the biggest one is, well, so part of it, I think, was some of the issues that they have. And I think that's just a lack of athleticism is the number one. But they also, it was weird because two of the things they're historically great at this year failed them. One was their defensive rebounding. And then the other is that they had one of the best benches of all time, and their bench got smoked the last two games. And that's been a big problem. Like, all of the Spurs starters were in the green in this game. And guys like Slow-Mo played 8 minutes and were like negative 12.
Yeah, those were both really big factors in this game. And then the other one that bothered me a lot, and it also bothered our mutual friend Seth Partnow, is that the Spurs offense is not so good that they can just do their thing and not take advantage of what the other team is giving them. And other than a brief stretch where they were exploiting the fact that Enes Kanter is weak at defending in space, they weren't doing much offensively of taking advantage of the other team's weaknesses. And that's frustrating because You know, you have to, in the playoffs, you have to take it, you have to do that. That's just the way that you win games.
Now, this actually really would be another case of that, now that I think about it, because this is a team, throughout the year, we said, hey, these guys, you know, they're not playing the beautiful game anymore. They go to a lot of ISOs. It's a lot of mid-rangers that are self-created, and they really just couldn't get that going in this game. In the last four games, their offensive rating is 99.2. That would have put them 28th in the league behind Phoenix this year, and they were third in, it was like 108 during the regular year. So what they did during the regular season worked awesomely. Kawhi was unstoppable, LaMarcus was unstoppable, and now they're just, those mid-rangers have really dried up. LaMarcus was 1 out of 11 from mid-range, really just did not look like the ball was coming off of his hand the way he might have wanted it to. And I think that, you know, you could say maybe that hand injury is a problem for him, but he also was hitting like crazy for the rest of the series up until now. So, but the Spurs were 8 out of 35 from mid-range. And not only is that bad because of the percentage is so bad, but that's 35 shots. You know, that's just a crazy number of shots. And the only reason, like, yeah, when you take 35 shots outside of the paint that are twos, yeah, you could have this kind of night. And that's what ended up happening to them against a team that finally had the athleticism to deal with their guys one-on-one.
Yeah, and while less of them were live ball turnovers than you might expect, Oklahoma City turned the ball over 20 times in this game. So it's not like it was a situation where OKC had a perfect outcome and the Spurs just couldn't, you know, they couldn't muster enough. They had some chances and didn't use them.
Yeah, I thought that was true, and Oklahoma City deserves a ton of credit. Billy Donovan, everyone and their brother has killed him. I was never quite as low on him as I think a lot of people were. I think that just, you know, the inability to get more motion with the system, but I thought that he learned a lot throughout the course of the year. That, yeah, he made some kind of interesting decisions in rotations, but he actually went back to the guys that he played most of the year, and he's absolutely got the most out of these guys in the series. Like, there's no question about that. The Cantor, who would have thought that Cantor and Steven Adams would be the front court? There wouldn't even be Ibaka. That would just be killing the Spurs. And while I think the Spurs could have done a little bit better job of attacking them, you know, they did go to Parker and pick and roll pretty much every single time down the stretch, and he just wasn't able to convert. He was able to get okay shots, but just wasn't able to do it.
Yeah, and something to kind of have in the back of your mind as we go through this game, you don't have to do it necessarily right now, is I tweeted out the Spurs shot chart for the last 4 minutes of this game, and just to get an idea of what they were generating is kind of a good idea of what we've been talking about here. And, you know, some of that is, of course, good defense, that good defense forces you to take worse shots, but also some of it is by design. And those shots, yeah, they were going in the year, but it's even with the best mid-range shooters, you're going to have nights like this.
Another thing to kind of think of before we really get into the nitty-gritty on this game is there's been talk that the offensive rebound has been devalued. Well, that the offensive rebound has now killed two teams. It's killed the Spurs and the Hawks as well. Now, you can't, the Hawks, you can criticize that their team isn't built well enough to get defensive rebounds. And, you know, obviously not every team can have every strength, you know, that's, and Tristan Thompson, especially, and the Cavs are a unique animal in the Eastern Conference with the amount of offensive rebounding that they do. And same thing you could say maybe with the Thunder in the West. And so now perhaps teams will say, hey, we've gone a little bit too far away from offensive rebounding, especially when in the playoffs, teams aren't really going to fast break on you. You know, the Spurs are not really going to fast break off a miss. They will off a turnover. Hey, why not send two massive dudes to the offensive glass and see what you can do? And they were able to take advantage too. Tim Duncan, I thought, played pretty well, but so many of the offensive rebounds came on plays where he was providing help. And then, you know, it was just LaMarcus and Tony Parker on the backside. I thought that was actually one downside for the Spurs of putting Kawhi Leonard on Russell Westbrook, was that he was always at the top of the floor. He wasn't able to really get into the rebounding action as much as you might have hoped defensively, and they really needed him.
And also, that's the benefit of having two bigs that are relatively low usage, because they know that they can be there. You know, like, even if Cantor, there's one play that we'll talk about where Cantor was on the backside of the three-point line, he can still get there by the time that shot goes up, and he can do that. And so it's a little bit different, especially when sometimes they're not involved in the action when it's an ISO. That actually opens the door for offensive rebounding from those guys.
So let's get into kind of the nitty-gritty now. We can start even through the first quarter. You know, I had noticed that Ibaka hasn't closed these last two games, and he really just has had such an inconsistent series, especially defensively. Like, he'll fluctuate between a great stop in the post and a great block, and then on the next play he just gets ducked in for a foul, or he lets Boris Diaw, like, go into his right hand immediately. But, you know, that was, and I think I probably said that they should have gone with Ibaka down the stretch. I was wrong about that. Kanter had two massive buckets on the end and actually played some pretty good D too, as we'll get to. But and I thought they needed the spacing from Ibaka, but they just managed to manufacture just enough buckets that it seems like Kanter was the right choice.
And one of the other huge stretches in this game, and another piece of credit that Billy Donovan deserves, even though it took him a little while to get there, is staggering his stars, because that gave them a baseline that was better than what the Spurs did, because the Spurs pulled Kawhi and Danny Green at the same time, and Kevin Durant was out on the floor, and that's what propelled them to one of their early leads.
Yeah, those guys like playing together, and I think that maybe that was part of it, was just that, hey, he had to sell these guys on that they would have to play a part. You'd think that a star would be like, hey, I have to run the show completely, but they did like playing together, and so being able to sell them on that was huge, because especially when times when Durant was in, and then Pop went at the same time without LaMarcus and without Kawhi, and with Kyle Anderson guarding Durant, both times when that happened, immediately there was a 5-0 run for Oklahoma City. And that's 10 points in the game. You know, if they'd had... And the biggest thing that I felt like Pop could have done better in the rotations is Danny Green only played 29 minutes, and he was on fire in this game too, right? Like, Pop loves to yell at Danny Green, and I think he still doesn't realize how valuable of a player that he is, when why not just play Danny Green 37 minutes? I mean, I'm asking you legitimately, like, is there a reason why that you could think of that you wouldn't just play Danny Green 37 minutes and play Slo-Mo 8 less minutes?
It didn't look like he was tired out there, and his defensive versatility, since you can slide him onto Durant, means that you can play him with a larger variety of guys. So I fully agree with you that they should do that.
Now, I guess the only thing you could say is, hey, you know, the second unit needs, like, a little bit more playmaking. But, like, did Slo-Mo even touch the ball, like, once in the entire game? Like, I'd be curious to know how many touches he had, actually. It wasn't many. And he's not going to score one-on-one. Like, he's not a guy who can shoot threes. His game is kind of working it around for a mid-range jumper and pulling up and kind of fading away. Like, you're not going to give him the ball in, game five of a playoff series. You go and do that. So why bother with him, And then we talked about Jonathan Simmons, who is a part of the rotation to begin with. I don't want to be too harsh on Pop, because, maybe he just makes too many mistakes. But just giving him more of a shot to just have one guy who plays with some force and some athleticism, that backup unit for the Spurs, incredible though it was all year, really lacks any type of player of that ilk. And then Patty Mills, too, couldn't hit a shot. He's been off this entire series, despite getting, like, some pretty good looks, especially earlier on in the series.
So before this season started, I wrote a piece for Hardwood Paroxysm, which I kind of talked about the idea of counterweights. And what I define that term as is a player who has the strength of taking away another player's strength. And so the Spurs actually have a lot of guys who fit that bill. And the two best are their two best defensive perimeter guys, which is Danny Green and Kawhi Leonard. I mean, they both have other strengths as well. But you have guys like that on your team for players like Kevin Durant. And more so than Westbrook, just because Westbrook can kind of get in his own way sometimes, and I'm sure we'll talk about how he can do that sometimes and how the Spurs handled him a little bit better later in the game. But you want to make damn sure that you have one of those guys that can make Durant's life hard on the floor every minute Durant is out there, and you sacrifice chemistry and things like that because he is so good that he will make you pay if you don't.
Yeah, and I don't want to harp on these sort of things too much. We could certainly go too far in the weeds with the Wednesday morning quarterbacking. But, in game two, they lost by one, and Pop putting Kyle Anderson to guard Kevin Durant at the end of the half, for no reason. And Durant got an easy bucket right away at his expense. And in this game, he went in and he was negative 12. He wasn't that helpful. And, not every bucket was at his expense. You could point to a million other things, and I'm sure Pop would in private, about here's where our breakdowns were, if we had just done this better. It's not just rotations. It's an easy thing to harp on for us. And, we'll try and talk about some of the things that went wrong on film, too, and that went right for Oklahoma City, which we're probably, not focusing on enough because we're negative people. But, yeah, those are things that we could be talking about that in this series for a while. Now, who knows, maybe Golden State just kills whoever comes out of this series, and then this isn't really going to matter that much in the grand scheme of things in the NBA. But at the very least, you'd have to think, if Kevin Durant were going to go to Golden State, the way it was going to happen is the Spurs kill the Thunder in this series. If they lose a series to Golden State, I feel like psychologically it becomes much harder to just, go join them immediately after losing to them in a playoff series. And then also, I think, you know, for that this is this Thunder team is a better matchup for Golden State at this point, too. I think we'll probably have a better Western Conference Finals now if indeed the Thunder go through.
Definitely a more exciting one. I think you can make that argument. And it could be closer. The Thunder, we've talked about this, have a higher variance. But the reason why I'm kind of fixated on that is that, for me, this is actually something I got asked about this, about why I get frustrated by the Sacramento Kings, is that, and I'm not making an analogy between the two, is that there's a difference between preventable mistakes and non-preventable mistakes. If you just get beat, you know, that's just the way it is. But if it's something that was close and within the margin, and there were things that could have made that difference that were somewhat, you know, not apparent or obvious in that way, but that could have been done, I'm going to fixate on that, because while there are other things, there are random bounces in this game, like there that could have gone either way. I mean, there were a couple of Marcus plays that nearly went in, you know, we would be having a different conversation. But in the playoffs, the margins are so tight that those kind of things are going to loom large, and we're going to talk about them.
Down the end of the second quarter, there are a number of interesting things that went on. One was, as you and Seth were really beating the drum on this, that they finally started putting Kanter in pick and roll and got some good stuff out of it.
Yeah, they had an 8-0 run at the end of the quarter, and part of that was also because Adams was out. He was limping. I don't know if it was related to that or just because he was out. And so it was Adams and Nick Collison, another thing we've harped on before. Kanter and Nick Collison.
Yeah.
And the Spurs went on an 8-0 run that really brought them back into this game.
Yeah, there it was 43-40. They scored the last 8 points that happened. So, you know, if OKC had lost, we'd probably be killing him for putting in Nick Collison, who was in for 5 of those points, you know, and Collison is kind of a guy who shouldn't really be playing anymore. And you know, again, those weren't necessarily at Collison's expense, but he didn't do anything to prevent it. And just not having your best lineup on the floor. The other thing, too, is Oklahoma City was just shooting themselves in the foot with that 26% turnover rate in the first half. But a lot of those were really kind of unforced turnovers. As you noted, there were very few live ball. And so the Spurs didn't get many points off turnovers, but then they weren't really doing anything to really kind of be deserving those turnovers necessarily either. It was OKC just throwing the ball away, traveling, you know, committing offensive fouls, those sorts of plays.
And that's why when you look at miscues like that, you see whether it's sustainable or not. And when I saw what Oklahoma City was doing, it's like you have to take advantage of it, not because they're giving you these live ball turnovers, but because that's the kind of mistake, especially with a team that plays as much isolation ball as Oklahoma City does, those aren't going to continue.
Even then, to start the third quarter, the Spurs were really playing some good ball. It was more pick and roll. Even when they were doing their post-ups, it was getting the ball into the post, you know, on kind of misdirections, pick and rolls to start it off. Their offense looked really good, and you started to think, all right, maybe this they went up by 13. You feel like the Spurs are going to take this. And, I mean, how are you feeling kind of at that point of the game? Do you feel like, all right, the Spurs have kind of restored order here and that's going to be it?
I thought that they had restored order, but I didn't have a ton of confidence, because there have been so many other times in this series where their offense has stagnated that I thought that, you know, oh, if they keep it going, then they should get away with this in a walk. But I had seen enough precedent to know that that wasn't a reasonable expectation.
Yeah, and then, of course, part of how they came back in was at the end of that third quarter, when the Spurs again went to their reserves. And then another key stretch was right at the start of the fourth. The Danny Green got a three, and they were up 78-72. And then Russ hit a ridiculous three with like one on the shot clock, you know, from Steph Curry range. And you pop afterwards, like you could see him, you know, he was standing right next to the play and just like put his head in his hands, just like, I can't believe he made that shot. We D'd this up so perfectly after they took forever to get into the play. And then the next time down, Russ was able to push the ball, and they got a three from KD after the Spurs miscommunicated in transition. And really, you know, I would love to see how well the Thunder score on plays where Russ gets a defensive rebound in this series. And when he crosses half court, you know, within 3 seconds of the shot clock starting, because those are the plays that they've been unstoppable on. The rest of the time, they really struggled to create offense.
And I think we're going to see a lot more of that around the league in the next couple of years as teams realize how successful it can be offensively. The Warriors do the same thing with Draymond Green when he gets the chance. And guys who can get the ball, who can push it quickly and make good decisions, it is one of the most reliable ways to get buckets.
Tim Duncan only had one defensive rebound, didn't score all that well. He did not close the game at all, either game, I don't think, in Oklahoma City. How did you feel like he played tonight overall?
He was all right. I think that some of the issues in terms of defensive rebounding, you brought this up earlier, were related to him being the help guy, and of course he is very good at that. He is their best rim protector.
Yeah. Although I will say this, you know, Duncan is legendary for his ability to help and not overcommit and still help protect the boards, and he was not able to do that in this
game. No, but that's true, and it's also harder to do that when the other team is playing two bigs, because if you have to help off, then that creates, in a way, an unwinnable situation, and of course it takes him more time, to cover that same distance, so it's going to be harder in that kind of a case, but most of the time I think he made the right choice. It's just a different choice than it used to be.
Yeah, and he also is, you know, not really a threat shooting the ball on one of the key plays of the game, in fact, on the end that became an issue with them helping off him. But I will say this, he was the best choice they had. You know, he was the only guy who could actually provide any protection or pick and roll defense among their bigs. And again, the fact that they just do not have anyone among their bigs who has some athleticism, who, you know, can get on the defensive glass, who can really move their feet in pick and roll defense. You know, that was going to end up being fatal if they face the Warriors, and could still be if they win the series. But it also is a problem against KD, who's another guy you really have to get up on in the pick and roll. And even against Westbrook, even though you can kind of lay back against him a little bit more, and Duncan did a better job of that. He had been too far up in game four, and that let Steven Adams get a bunch of dunks. Like, they took that away in the pick and roll, at least. But, you know, still, just the lack of athleticism, that's the biggest thing that stood out for me for the Spurs today. And Oklahoma City, with the force and athleticism that they played with. And, you know, they also, Oklahoma City probably made less mistakes than the Spurs did in this game.
Yeah, I think that's an underrated part of really what happened in this. And on the athleticism note, we're going to get into a more of a breakdown, but this is a general point. In the final 5 minutes of this game, San Antonio, in terms of their players grabbing them, they had some team rebounds. Their players grabbed a total of 2 rebounds, offensive, defensive combined. One was LaMarcus Aldridge grabbing the ball that went straight to him off Enes Kanter's block. The other one was Tony Parker off of Kawhi Leonard's miss down 4 with a couple seconds to go. That's it. Those are all the rebounds that were grabbed by a San Antonio Spur in that time. That is problematic. It's hard to win a game that is close in that kind of a context, no matter what happens. And there weren't, like, egregiously bad calls. Like, I heard some people harping on Twitter about, oh, you know, the refs and all that. There were some mistakes in this, but that kind of a thing is unsustainable regardless of the calls.
Yeah, while Kanter and Adams were on the floor, the Thunder, as per our buddy Dan Feldman, offensive rebounded 61% of their misses, and defensive rebounded 84% of the Spurs' misses, which is absolutely incredible. And, you know, part of what that stat you talked about is that the Spurs got some turnovers. Tim Duncan blocked a shot out of bounds. You know, they didn't have many chances to get a defensive rebound, but when they did, they did not get it.
And they didn't get, and those two were offensive rebounds, because in the last 6 minutes and 2 seconds, they didn't get a defensive rebound.
All right, we'll pick it up as we really go through, put some context onto some of the things we've been saying about, you know, what the mistakes were for the Spurs late, and how the Thunder's athleticism was so huge. But first, let me tell you about our friends at Betterment. You can learn more about them at betterment.com/capspace. URL, that's betterment.com/capspace. Betterment is the largest independent automated investing service out there. You've probably been hearing a lot about them in TechCrunch, the Wall Street Journal, other news, and the reason why is that they make it easier, more straightforward, and less expensive to invest. It's built on smarter, cutting-edge technology to bring you sophisticated investing and financial advice, all at a lower cost than more traditional financial services because it's automated. More than 150,000 customers choose Betterment's advanced advice algorithms and beautiful user interface to manage over $4 billion of their dollars. And, of course, this is the perfect time to get started with Betterment and saving for your retirement or other financial goals, because Dunked On listeners can get up to 6 months of no fees. You can learn how at that betterment.com/capspace URL. Go check it out. Even if you're not ready to invest yet, you can learn more. That helps us as well to just go to the URL and take a look at it, maybe for when you might be ready to invest in the future. Betterment.com/capspace, investing made better. All right, let's pick it up here with 5:45 remaining. And the Spurs ran a play, which was awesome, but I really don't recall them running at any other time. And that was kind of too bad, because Danny Green is an excellent shooter. And this sort of play, a pin down for Danny Green, which was an ATO, put him up 5 when he hit the 3. He's good at those. You know, I mean, he's definitely hit plenty of those shots coming off of screens in his career, especially late in games at times. And Duncan is a great screener. The Thunder bigs, not the sort who are going to help all the way out, you know, 25 feet from the basket to prevent a three. And, you know, he set a screen on Russell Westbrook after they got a switch. I think that was part of the genius of the play as well, to get Russ onto Green, and Russ is not very good at navigating screens. Duncan set a monster screen, and Green drained a three, and it kind of made you wonder, like, why they just didn't do more of those kind of plays to really take advantage of the Thunder's communication deficit on defense.
And while Tim Duncan is less of an offensive threat of a scoring threat as a screener, when you set really good screens, you can accomplish a different goal, which is creating separation for somebody else. And I understand why they want to use LaMarcus more as a screener, particularly when it involves the ball handler and, you know, pick and pop situations and things like that. But there is an incredible value to just getting another player more space to operate.
So the next time down, this is one that people weren't talking about, a total phantom call on Danny Green, who was just sort of in the area with Durant denying him, but barely made contact with him at all. Kawhi Leonard deflected a pass from Russ and was about to pick it up and maybe go in for a layup. And they blew the whistle saying that Green had somehow pushed Durant. And maybe they did because the pass was so off from Durant, but they didn't see that Kawhi, with his crazy long arms, had deflected it. So that was definitely a big swing for the Spurs. And then in the resulting play, Kevin Durant just did a one-on-one drive against Green, and the sort of play that you feel like is just not going to work because Cantor and Adams are basically standing on either block. There's no spacing at all, and the Spurs had three guys in the paint, and KD somehow shuffled a pass to Adams. He got stripped and then was able to still lay it in as Duncan had just committed just enough to Durant to allow the pass to take place.
And that's one of the virtues of getting big men who have touch, because that kind of a shot, that whole situation, I don't think happens with a lot of the bigs in the league. And the fact that you can get it in Adams in particular, who is a solid defender, is a huge perk for Oklahoma City that a lot of other teams just don't have.
Yeah, Adams, I wouldn't say that he has amazing touch, but he has really worked on it. One of the things I think we talked about in our early 15 and 60s was that he really needed to improve his finishing around the rim, that he just didn't shoot a good enough percentage for a guy who's that's his only job. And he's actually developed a little bit of a floater on, you know, short range from the dotted line on pick and rolls as well. Not quite a guy who's going to make decisions further out in the floor when there's a trap, which is kind of amazing that the Thunder don't have a single big man who can do anything off of a short roll when you have Kevin Durant on your team, who you kind of basically have to double at the three-point line on any pick and roll. But nonetheless, they're able to get it done, and Adams, to his credit, has really worked on those shots.
So in the next possession down, Kawhi had it, isolation on Durant, but he goes past Durant and basically goes past Adams and then somehow shoots, I don't even know if it counts as a hook shot, but just shot over both of them.
Yeah, it was a Kawhi-so ball once again, and I don't know how he did that. Like that was just an impossible shot along the baseline, fading away. You know, he had to shoot it with a right-hand hook from the left side, because if he had just gone up for a normal turnaround, he probably would have just hit the side of the backboard. Just a ridiculous shot. Had no business going in. Great D. And I thought overall Durant, and that I think was Kawhi's last play, other than hitting one out of two free throws on kind of a dubious foul call on Durant later on, Durant did well on him, and just as he did it in game four. And I thought the reason was just that his length and the fact that he was able to play off of Kawhi, not let Kawhi get his body into him, knock him backwards, really kind of flummoxed Kawhi. It's a different sort of defender. Durant's a different sort of defender than just about exists in the league. But he was crafted in a lab perfectly to take away the type of game that Kawhi likes to use.
Yeah, your insight from game four was just as relevant here. And he also, to his credit, did a nice job of denying Kawhi the position. We'll talk about a play later where Kawhi was trying to get to a specific spot and he just couldn't. And that's a little bit different than what Durant was doing, but he succeeded at that as well.
So this was another of the Spurs' mental mistakes down the stretch. Duncan, great block on Russell Westbrook, 7 on the shot clock. And they switch the inbounds play. Steven Adams catches the ball 15 feet from the hoop, and Danny Green just reaches on him, gets completely on the opposite side of the basket from Adams, and Adams just turns around, takes a dribble, and goes in and dunks. It was just like, I don't know what Green was thinking. Maybe he was thinking there was going to be some kind of a handoff that he could step out on, or just thought like Adams just wasn't that good and he could steal it from him. Whatever it was, it was just a terrible gamble considering how late the clock was, how little of a threat Steven Adams is from the spot that he was, unless you just completely move out of his way and let him roll in for a dunk. And that's what he did. That made it 85-82.
I want to go back a little bit, though, to the block. And what made that happen was that Duncan laid back on the pick and roll as opposed to being up on it. And so what they learned, and something that we've harped on for this entire series, is that Russell Westbrook is a lot more dangerous as a driver than as a shooter. And he can be flawed, you know, when finishing over size. And Duncan did a great job. It looked like the block might have actually, I don't think it hit Westbrook. It did not hit him.
I went back and looked very closely because Duncan started to say that, and then when they didn't give it to him, he didn't protest too hard because he realized, like, it was very close to hitting Russ's foot while he was laying out of bounds afterwards. But I know what you mean. And then, so the next time was that questionable foul call on Kawhi driving on KD. They were going to do a screen. They actually were setting a screen with Duncan involving Cantor, and Kawhi just didn't wait for him, went early. And he only hit 1 out of 2 free throws, though. The Spurs, only 2 out of 4. I'm sorry, actually, I think Duncan was 2 for 2, but they're 4 out of 6 free throwing down the stretch. Again, another thing that you can kind of point to as the Thunder were perfect on their free throws down the stretch. So that's another thing that you can point to as kind of a Spurs issue, just as it was, you know, in that game 6 in 2013.
Yeah, and then one of the better San Antonio defensive possessions down the stretch, they tried to run a Durant Adams pick and roll. Duncan played it very well. They didn't get anything out of that. And then I thought the pass was forced by Durant, but I also think he probably didn't see where Kawhi was, because Kawhi was playing off of Westbrook, but in a way where he could get there if he had to. He just put his giant claw up there, got enough of the ball, stole it, and got that nice dunk, which put them up 88-82. So that was a 6-point lead.
Yeah, and that's with, you know, I think 4 minutes left. You know, your win expectancy up 6 with 4 minutes left is probably, 85%, something like that, even if the teams are equal. And then the Spurs just got into a rut where they only scored, I think, one more field goal the entire game from that point on, and one free throw. I don't think they did score another field goal after that. I think it was just 2 free throws by Duncan and one from Parker, and that was it.
I think you're right.
The next time, Russ, again, you know, he hit a couple of pretty crazy threes. This was actually a very long two to make it 88-84. This was after Green completely stoned KD. He had to hand it off to Russ, and then Green was on Russ and got a great contest. That's just one of those make-or-miss league type of shots to get the Thunder within 4 with 3:38 remaining.
And then the next play is actually the one that I was referring to before about Durant denying Kawhi the spot. So they tried to run a Kawhi-Tony Parker pick and roll, and he just couldn't get to the right spot. And then, you know, ended up that he gave the ball back to Parker because Kawhi hadn't gotten anything. And that actually set up one of the other important parts of this. And what happened is Parker put up a bad three, but just because the shot clock was expiring, Steven Adams grabbed the ball as the buzzer was going off. And actually, the way that I think the rule should be interpreted moving forward is to treat that as an advantage. However, that is not generally the way the league interprets it. And so, you know, it was never really whistled dead. And Westbrook decided, just screw it, I'm going to go. Went, and I think that it has been underrated in this how hard that layup was that he made.
Yeah, it was, and you know, he was basically 2 on 4. Cantor was the only other guy down there, but 2 of the 4 had just kind of stopped. Like Tim Duncan in particular just put his head down sort of after what he thought was the shot clock violation and just started walking back. You know, he didn't even look to see what was going on, and then by the time he saw it, he couldn't get back into the play. Meanwhile, Kawhi Leonard was sort of just, you know, assumed that Danny Green was going to pick up Russ, but he wasn't quite in position. Leonard was kind of pointing out to something on the opposite wing, probably to, like, go get Durant or something, and Russ just drove right by all those guys. And I think, you know, that's probably the way that it's been called all playoffs, should have been called a 24-second violation, but it is something that's not particularly consistent. And there's just, I mean, when you're tired at the end of a game, you're looking for an excuse to take a rest. And that, I think, especially after the discouragement of a shot clock violation, or nearly a shot clock violation, is something that you naturally are going to kind of do anyway. But you would think, you know, a veteran team like the Spurs, Tim Duncan, you know, about as veteran as it gets, about as mistake-free as it gets, and, you know, he made a mistake on that play. And Russ talked about it after the game. He said, I just go until they blow the whistle. And nobody ever blew the whistle. It was just the buzzer went off, no whistle. So, I mean, you just, the rest probably should have called it, but the Spurs had plenty of guys back if they had just gone for it, you know?
Yeah, and even with the few that were there, it was still a tough shot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what Russ, you know, we talk about how he just goes a million miles an hour and gets to the rim, and sometimes he makes it and sometimes he doesn't. This is one of the ones that he was able to put in.
And we've just been talking about fatigue. My personal diagnosis on the next play was that it was also fatigue-based, and so they ran a Kawhi-LaMarcus pick-and-roll on the side, And both guys shaded Kawhi, so he just threaded the needle with the pass to LaMarcus, and they conceded a pretty open shot from a little bit close in the free throw line that just went in and out.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the plays where maybe Cantor, who really didn't make any mistakes defensively, could have done a little better job, but still, you know, he's kind of under the basket on Duncan, and you might even say that someone from the weak side, you know, the weak side wing, it's their job to rotate in there, and said, you know, you don't know exactly what they're... it was interesting that actually they iced that pick and roll. They have not really been icing side pick and rolls very much in the series, but they did, and that allowed them to get right to the free throw line for Aldridge. It was one of the two just wide open jumpers that he missed on the end. So, you know, I don't think that the Spurs process was that terrible. I mean, they were getting open shots. You know, this isn't like DeMar DeRozan, Kyle Lowry jacking up a contested shot on every possession. They just couldn't make any of those open mid-range.
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple plays where I had beef with it. The one that just happened with Kawhi and Tony, there wasn't really, I didn't see any secondary actions that were really going to generate any fruit. And so that's a little bit hard when you have a full shot clock. But for the most part, they did a reasonable job. And we'll talk about a couple more plays where the shots just didn't go in.
So when they get the rebound from that, Russ would have had a fast break. There was about 2:45 left. And Donovan called timeout as he's taking his dribble up court. I hated that call, especially after Russ had just gotten a fast break, and at least just let him go. And like, if you're the coach, you can call timeout from the bench whenever you want. Like, let him push it up, see what happens. He's probably going to take a good shot, a better one than you're normally going to get. But at least to his credit, they ran a pretty decent ATO. They got a nice dribble handoff from Adams to get Russ going to the middle. We couldn't really see it that well because, thanks a lot, TNT. Definitely write to your congressperson on this one that having anything other than the normal angle is just terrible, especially in crunch time. But Russ missed the J from the free throw line. Good contest from Aldridge. And then Tim Duncan, I don't know whether he really got thrown by Adams. You couldn't really see it on the film, or he kind of flopped a little bit. But he basically, you know, fell down, and Russ was able to beat Aldridge and Leonard to the rebound, and then with Duncan still on the ground, was able to find Cantor wide open underneath the rim for what was a huge bucket to tie it.
Yeah, that was a massive play. And then, actually, so then there was an earlier play where Parker had an amazing pass to Danny Green that echoed the Curry-Harrison Barnes play from the Blazers game the night before. But the Spurs actually did the same thing that the Warriors were doing on that play. It just was executed a little bit differently. I classified it as that Kawhi was doing kind of like the midget. I'm not sure if that's exactly what was right, but he ran along the baseline, and the pass that was open was to Tim Duncan.
Yeah, it was the same play. It wasn't an out-of-bounds play, but it was an ATO because it was their first play after the timeout. So Kawhi ran what's called an Iverson cut, where you start on one wing, come off of a screen into an area where you wouldn't normally be getting a screen to, which is basically from one wing going to the other. But when you do that, you can get your man a little bit behind you and just have him a half step behind. The Sixers would do that all the time for Allen Iverson and then let him blow to the basket because, you know, whoever was behind him was just a little bit too slow. And KD did a nice job getting through it. But again, the same thing that they did with Curry, the play was for Danny Green to get a corner three with Tim Duncan setting the screen. Enes Kanter was actually all over it. He was guarding Duncan, and he actually followed Kawhi out to the corner, cut off the pass, and then Deion Waiters got through the screen as well. Both those guys were totally on it, and so they had to throw it back to Duncan at the elbow. He drove in, pump fake, got Adams in the air. It was a sure two, and Kanter, with a great multiple effort that you would not ever associate with the name Enes Kanter, came all the way over from the corner where he had followed Kawhi to just reject Duncan's shot right into the hands of Aldridge, who missed then the wide-open mid-ranger.
And that was their first rebound in the last 5 minutes.
Yeah, which was not exactly, you know, out-toughing him on the glass. He just blocked it in the air. I mean, it's just... I was just shocked that Kanter was able to make that play. He had another great block as well in this game. So, yeah, you know, maybe there's a little something to the idea that when you're 22, 23 years old, that you are fully formed defensively. And he certainly, say what you will about him, whether they put him in pick and roll enough or not, he, at the very least, has improved this year. I don't think that's inarguable.
Absolutely. And he deserves a lot of credit for trying more now than he did. And that especially when a guy is reasonably athletic, which Kanter is, that can get you to a reasonable level. And he does have these weaknesses in space. But when you're not challenging him to do those things, and again, this was a diagnosis play. He did a nice job recognizing it, and an effort play because to get back and to impact that, and the Duncan shot, I think, based on my limited read of it, looked like it was going to go in. And then the other huge part of this play is it went right to LaMarcus Aldridge, deep to the type of shot that he's been making his entire life, in and out.
Yeah, At this point, then, KD had a post up on Danny Green from, you know, which Russ had threw one of those long looping passes. Green kind of went for the steal, didn't get it. KD had a good floater. Duncan had to go all the way over, really got in the air to contest it. He forced a miss. But the problem was then it was Cantor and Adams 2-on-1 down against Aldridge and Tony Parker, who was kind of even out of the play. Kawhi was out of the play guarding Russ way up at the top. And Cantor was able to just get an easy tip in. Adams engaged Aldridge. And it's just, you know, that's what happens when you're playing two centers. I don't really know what the Spurs could have done differently. Maybe you could say, all right, Kawhi should have crashed the glass a little bit harder. But, you know, Cantor was right there. And just so much of offensive rebounding is just having a nose for it and having the commitment to send two guys there. And on that play, it bounced right to Cantor. And great job by him to finish it. And give the Thunder their first lead in a while, 90-88 with 1:45 remaining at that point.
And you also wanted, it was a little bit of good fortune for Oklahoma City that he missed it long instead of short, because then it went right to Cantor. You didn't even, you know, he was in the right place at the right time, though I think they probably would have gotten the rebound anyway if it had gone short, but it definitely made it more practical because Cantor had come from he had been at the three-point line and just came in on the shot.
Yeah, and actually, I was wrong. Duncan didn't have, this was before this period we were talking about, that Duncan had those two free throws. The next time down for the Spurs was a pick and roll with Tony Parker and LaMarcus. Every action that they ran, I think, for the next 3-4 possessions was that Russell Westbrook got screened off. Parker hit a nice pull-up, going to his right over Steven Adams. Again, one of those ones where he accelerated, planted a foot, and just stopped and shot it. Good shot by him. Tough position to put Adams in, where Russell Westbrook just not able to even provide any sort of contest following Parker off the screen. And that ended up tying it. And, you know, you thought still the Spurs might be in decent shape because Danny Green got a steal off of a KD post-up on the next time down.
Yeah, I personally thought that was a bad pass from Russ to Durant.
Yeah, he was pissed at KD, I guess, for not holding him off, which maybe he should be. But, you know, and a lot of times NBA players will just be lazy and throw that pass way up in the air and you just expect the guy to hold him off. But Green did a nice job fighting around him. High risk, high reward. You know, he did a similar play against Adams and gave up a dunk, but it worked out this time. But then Parker was not able to go one-on-one against Russ. The old school Tony Parker would have gone to the basket and tried, you know, faked Russ out, done a spin move or a floater or something, and probably scored. Parker was not able to do that. He kind of just pulled it out, and then they weren't really able to get a great shot on that possession.
Yeah, and Durant, it's funny, we both had almost identical notes in this, that Durant did a nice job getting back, because Danny Green would have been open too. I'm openly dubious about whether Danny Green would have made that play if he had to, unless it was a dunk.
Yeah, because what I tweeted about him the other day is that Danny Green, when he's playing defense against fast breaks, turns everyone on offense into what he is on a fast break on offense himself, because he is just so bad at making fast break layups.
And so then it took a long time. It felt like to me that considering it was an aborted fast break, it took a little while for the Spurs to actually get going. They ended up running a dribble handoff from Duncan for Parker, and he got a deep two. It was a clean enough look, but, you know, I personally think that they can do better than that, but it certainly could have gone in.
I think it might have been Aldridge, actually, because it was Adams who ended up contesting it, and he was the one who guarded Aldridge. And actually, Dwight Howard, of all people, noted this on the postgame show, which I thought was a good observation, that putting Steven Adams on Aldridge really took away Aldridge's postgame, because we remember early on when he was going against Ibaka, he was able to knock him back, get in, and early on in the series, and get to hook shot range, you know, with both his left hand. He was flashing a beautiful left hand. He was getting, you know, into the dotted line and closer for right-handed jump hooks or, you know, shorter turnarounds. And Steven Adams isn't going to get back down like that by LaMarcus Aldridge. He is, you know, just a big, strong boy. There are not many people in the league who are going to knock that dude backwards. And LaMarcus, who's kind of more of a pure power forward, is not falling into that category. And so then for LaMarcus, it was, now, you know, he's not going to blow by guys facing up. Adams is probably actually has quicker feet than he does, too. So then it's kind of, you know, the 15-foot fadeaways that, you know, are kind of the bad parts of LaMarcus's game. And that's why I think the Spurs went away from him in the post, which is probably the right decision, frankly. But a good move by Coach Donovan in what has been a series of them putting Adams onto Aldridge.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And the next play was another one that some people are griping about with the announcing. And I think
this is the key play of the game. I think.
You think? Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, I think. Yeah, I guess you can make that argument.
I mean, this is the one that put him up right there. It was a minute left. And, you know, you can talk about the foul by Green. One thing that I noticed, though, is that KD a lot of times doesn't work hard enough to get open, isn't strong enough to get open. And after the last play in which Green basically like went right through him to get the steal. KD finally like moved with some force and he grabbed Green kind of by his wrist, threw him aside, went off the screen by Adams, got an open jumper, which he missed. Who knows whether he missed it because Danny Green was falling under his feet either. But, you know, Steven Adams probably committed an offensive foul by very subtly moving his left foot back and tripping Green. And, you know, that's another one of these ones that's just really hard for a ref to see. I went back and watched it, and, you know, the referee's job, number one, I mean, he's think of it this way, right? Just like the angle that your head and your eyes have to be at. He's maybe 5 feet away from Durant, 6 feet away. Durant's 7 feet tall. You're looking, first of all, to see is there any contact on the arm while he's shooting the ball. And so to be looking up and focusing on that, and then also to see basically, you know, a completely different angle for your head, Adam's foot catching Green's foot, it's almost just impossible. You know, so it was just a great kind of dirty tricks play by Adams, wise beyond his years, perhaps, and unfair to the Spurs, for sure, that wasn't an offensive foul. But, you know, those are the breaks, and as we've talked about ad nauseum on this show, that when it's this close, you are putting yourself at the mercy of potentially a call that could be missed.
And there's another aspect of this that it can be conducive to criticism, because the camera angle had a better angle on the foul than any of the refs did. And
right, like, because that guy, remember, that guy's sitting on the ground, the guy who is filming that from the baseline, right? So he actually has the angle to where you could see the trip and still sort of see KD shooting it as well. Like, if you're a 6 foot tall person and you're standing, you know, you just have to have incredible field of vision, you know, vertically to see both of those things happening at the same time.
So interpret it as intentional. Like, it could have just, you could have even seen it as incidental, and then you're probably still going to call it the same way.
Yeah. And Adams did sort of coyly say after the game, yeah, there was some contact. I got pushed back and I was just trying to regain my balance, whatever. That was probably hogwash, frankly. But, you know, that cheeky New Zealander, you know, with his easy humor can pull one over on all of us, I guess.
So the next play, I referred to it as a perfunctory screen by LaMarcus because he didn't really get any contact. It was just enough to make it so that they needed a switch. And Adams committed the foul, completely understandable foul because they were beat.
Yeah, I don't say. I mean, yeah, it wasn't a bad screen. I mean, because Parker was able to just blow by Russ again. I think Aldridge was kind of setting up on one side, and Russ did not force him to use the screen. Made no effort to go under either. You know, I think that's another thing that you can do against Parker. I mean, Russ did not do a good job on Parker towards the end. You know, he's just not a good on-ball defender when it comes to screens. You know, I mean, you have to do one of two things. Either you get up on him, close down the space, and take away the angle for him to just blow to the basket and then get over the screen, or you back up enough so that you can go under and meet him on the other side. And he doesn't do either of those things. He just kind of stands there, gets screened, and isn't close enough to him that he can't just, like, start jetting immediately once the screen is set. You know, you need to be close enough to him that you force him to take a wider angle instead of just going straight to the basket. So it was a good call on Adams, but again, Parker, one out of two free throws. That could have tied it. It could have changed the whole game if he makes those free throws, and he just didn't. He was one out of two.
And then this is another circumstance that I thought was an underrated big part of the game. Of course, you had the free throws. And then despite the Thunder having the lead and having the ball, San Antonio got another chance because Danny Green, I thought, did a really nice job getting that strip and just trying to get a look out of it.
Yeah, the biggest thing that I thought showed up to me about this part was that they went too early.
Yeah.
And, you know, usually I say in the last 5 minutes, the last 3 minutes, the last 2 minutes, run your normal offense. Don't worry about wasting time because you're just going to get some terrible shots, even if you're ahead by a little bit. But in this one, up by one, you have to run it down. And it was very interesting. You know, he turned it over with 9 seconds left on the shot clock. You know, I mean, this is one of those ones. They actually ran a real play. They set him off a pin down. Danny Green made a great strip, to be sure. But again, they just went too early. You know, that's probably one of those ones where, much as it sucks, like, you just run an ISO and, you know, let KD shoot whatever jump shot he wants to take over Green and make sure you get back on defense. They were lucky that the Spurs did not just get a fast break. And this, again, was out of a timeout, which, you know, I thought was better for Billy Donovan because you wanted to set up a play that would use up all the time. They didn't actually do that out of the timeout. And then the Spurs had their own play coming out of the timeout. The Thunder were matched up differently. It was KD guarding Tony Parker. He threw it to Aldridge on the wing. And a play that the Spurs run all the time, you can go back to early last year, Manu Ginobili beat Joe Harris on the same play. You remember Joe Harris was getting ticked for the Cavs early last year when they were a 500 team. That seems like a million years ago. But where you start under the basket, you fake what's called a zipper cut where you just go straight up to the top of the key and then hard plant, try to go back door. Russ was guarding Kawhi. He was all over it. And then Steven Adams as well, guarding Duncan, he was all over it too. You know, they were both there. Adams was not guarding Tim Duncan at all. They had been matched up differently, that Cantor was actually on Aldridge out near the three-point line. And maybe you would have liked to see them get Aldridge a chance to go one-on-one against Cantor, Kawhi in the post against Russ, but that wasn't what the play call ended up being. It ended up being a pick and roll again, and Parker was again able to beat Russ, but Steven Adams stepped out pretty darn far and was able to get a good contest. Parker a little bit further out than he likes to be on that mid-ranger, was well short, and the ball went out of bounds in the corner. No one was able to grab it, and that was looked like it was going to be about it with 9 seconds left. That 9 seconds, ironically, the exact 9 seconds that KD had failed to waste. So, you know, it worked out okay because the Spurs never got a chance to tie. But if the foul had just been called on the next possession, the Spurs would have got a chance to tie because the Thunder failed to adequately run the time down in the previous possession.
Did you have any issue with Parker taking that shot with 7 seconds left on the shot clock? Because I thought, you know, it is hard, of course, with that little time left to try to get something else. But that's just not a good look for this team.
Yeah, well, I think with 7 left on the shot clock, you can't confirm that you're going to get a better look at that point. I think he just had to take it. Steven Adams did a nice job. That's just as good as they were able to do on that play. I think the way that Russ had been defending Tony, it was all right. But, you know, part of the problem is just that Tony Parker isn't the same guy that he was 3 or 4 years ago. He's not going to get to the basket or be able to shoot a floater in that situation going downhill one-on-one against Adams the way he might have been able to do 5 years ago, 7 years ago.
So then before the next play happened, there was a fascinating dynamic because Russ got really mad at the ref for not giving him the ball fast enough.
Yeah, they did differently than they did in game two because they at least tried to get the inbound in the backcourt, which is what you should do. But yeah, the ref didn't give him the ball fast enough. I forgot who it was that down there in the corner. But so they couldn't get it in, and then they called timeout, setting up Waiters Ginobili part deux.
Ugh.
Hey, Waiters did a fine job.
He did. And Ginobili did too. I think that when I was watching the play live, Durant got separation on Danny Green, but the way he got separation was right in where Manu was blocking Waiters' line of sight, so he made the pass to Westbrook, which was completely the right decision.
Yeah, it was a very similar play to what they ran on the opposite side of the floor in game two. Adams really only screened for Durant, didn't particularly get him open. It was also Durant going right back towards the midcourt line where, you know, if he makes the catch, he could have either been trapped or would have been worried about a backcourt violation. Russ just did a great job getting open on Kawhi. You saw Monty McCutcheon make wave his arms in the air on the sideline to Manu before he inbounded it, saying basically, no, do not go over this. And then Waiters in some quotes afterwards was like, yeah, I was backing up, like getting plenty of room, you know, just kind of laughing about the whole thing afterwards. So they get it in, and then the play that everyone was just going completely apeshit over, Kawhi wraps up Russ. I mean, he doesn't tackle him, but enough to where you wouldn't want to do any more because you might be afraid of hurting a guy. Dead bang, clear foul. Kawhi has some of the longest arms in the league. I mean, he's got his whole forearm like hit Russ in the stomach enough that Russ was even kind of thrown off balance. No call somehow. I don't know how the refs were not looking for that, why they wouldn't think that's a call. I have no idea. And then Russ, inexplicably, instead of wasting more time, goes to the basket. If he misses that layup, the Spurs could have gotten it, and I think called timeout. I think they had a timeout still remaining.
I believe they did, yeah.
At the time, they did because they advanced the ball afterwards.
Yep.
Or, you know, even if he just makes that layup, you still haven't wasted any time, and it's still a three-point game. But LaMarcus called for the foul. That was a foul. It was definitely a foul, but, you know, less of a foul than it was when Kawhi was grabbing him on purpose. And so that was a three-point play for Russ on what was a pretty dumb play, frankly, to go and shoot that. But A, it worked out, and then they had an insurmountable lead, and that was it.
Wait, can I mention one more thing on this? So that
So
Russ, because of the way that everybody was structured on the play, Manu was on Waiters, and Danny Green was functionally out of the play based on everything that happened because he was on Durant. I think that if Russ had just realized what happened, and of course this is the snap judgment, I'm not saying, oh, it was a huge mistake or something. If he had realized what had happened, that the foul wasn't called, I think it would have taken them like 4 seconds to get, 3-4 seconds to get to him. I think they would have been able to burn a lot of the time off the clock. And I believe off the top of my head, the Thunder might have had another timeout left. I think they might have had one more. Either way, though, they could have burned a lot more time. It didn't end up mattering. It was the best possible workout for them. It was a horrendous call. Not the LaMarcus call. That was correct given the context. But that is a really bad break. It couldn't have worked out worse for the Spurs. But that's what happens sometimes.
Well, I'm going to go even further than that because this did not cost them the game. Russ is a great clutch free throw shooter. He made the one free throw already. You assume that you're going to be down three. And then they miss the ensuing three. You know, if you make that three-pointer, now maybe you can say, all right, it cost us the game. But it's not like they got some unbelievable look on that three-pointer down at the end either. Presumably Oklahoma City would have been playing even more intense defense. You know, they probably actually challenged a little bit too much, frankly, with the chance of a four-point play.
The one pushback I have on that is just that I think that from the Spurs' perspective, your mentality shifts a little bit when you're down four than when you're down three. I think they might have been able to get a better look, but it wouldn't have been that much better.
It's not a perfect proxy, that play that they ran, I'm sure, for what would or would not have happened, and maybe the Thunder would have been too tight or whatever. But still, your chances of making that shot are, you know, maybe 20%, if that.
On the Kawhi miss, the Spurs got their second rebound in the last 5 minutes.
All right, well, let's do a couple of smaller notes that I had just through the course of the game that I wanted to get to. Kawhi just has maybe the best core strength in the league. Like that shot that he made in the first half where he kind of pump faked in the air and was like almost, you know, at a 90-degree angle sideways banking it. And I was watching him very closely in the first half because I thought maybe he might have hurt his knee in game four. I think that he looked fine to me, ultimately. Didn't he to you?
Yeah, he looked fine. I didn't see anything that was an issue.
He didn't start off well, but he obviously picked it up.
He didn't start well, but I don't think that was a physical thing, you know, in that way.
Boris Diaw in the first half did not play as much in the second half, but he was very aggressive shooting his jump shot when he was wide open. He missed two shots, but I thought that was good that Pop was telling him, hey, we need you to shoot that with no hesitation. When the Spurs played their best offense in 2014, he was a 40% three-point shooter who, you know, didn't shoot it with no hesitation, but at least shot it. So I thought that was good, even though he got two good shots there. They didn't go down, but I thought that was good. Russell Westbrook's rebounding on the defensive end was awesome. He had a couple of plays where he like flew in over like David West, who is a good positional guy but can't jump at all. But that's, you know, a perfect example of how your wings and your point guard can help rebounding when, you know, a guy's kind of ground bound fighting for position. You can't really jump at all, so a shorter guy can get that rebound by being able to run in and get a better jump than the big guy can.
Yeah, I thought he did a great job, and defensive rebounding in particular is effort, positioning, and athleticism. And Westbrook is one of the best rebounding guards I can remember.
Robertson really struggled. The Spurs did not put Tim Duncan on him, but they did put Kawhi Leonard on him for a time and just let Kawhi kind of roam. I thought that Oklahoma City really struggled to score quite a bit in his minutes. And if I were Billy Donovan, I would just start Waiters in game six. You know, he's just been by far the best option there. No reason not to start your best guys. Robertson maybe can come in a little bit off the bench. But, you know, they're not going to do it because they won, and they've won three out of the last four games in the series with him in the role that he's in. But I do think you're kind of just giving away free points there. And I was reminded of what Carol Lawson said on my podcast when Russ threw a pass, was double teamed by Kawhi at the top of the key, threw a pass to Robertson wide open. And, you know, that's what you do. That's the right pass. If there's a guy standing in the corner, if the coach tells him to stand in the corner, that's because you expect him to take that shot. And, you know, as Kara said, it's not her job as the player to, you know, decide who I'm going to pass it to or not. That's what the system requires, is that pass. And if the coach wants to put someone else in, then the coach can handle that. You know, you just make the right pass as a player.
Yeah, agreed completely.
That Russ play where one of those crazy defensive rebounds that he had and then went full court and put Patty Mills right on his ass with a fake for a layup, that was awesome. That just
was one of the biggest highlights of the game.
Yeah, that was just fantastic. So now we got a game six, a mammoth game six in Oklahoma City. What are your adjustments if you are Greg Popovich?
I mean, my big one is use the player who Enes Kanter is guarding as your screener as much as humanly possible, partially because you'll get baskets and partially to get him out of the game.
I would say still try Tim Duncan on Robertson. That to me is the best of both worlds, with both the help and also still having Kawhi and Danny Green actively guarding Russ and KD. I might also even try going small against Kanter and Adams, with just put Kawhi at the four and get some shooting around it. Go with Parker, Manu, Danny Green, Kawhi, and either Duncan or Aldridge. And because their problem is they can't score in the series. You know, like, their defense has actually been okay. And now if you're going to make, I mean, who the heck is Enes Kanter or Steven Adams going to guard in that lineup? They're going to guard Danny Green? You know, like, I would actually, I might even put him on Parker or something. Like, you just, I think that if you did that, and maybe you're scared of, like, all right, KD at the four, but I think that their wings, neither of these team has great wings and personnel to play small with, but I think the Spurs wings are better, that they can take away that offensive rebounding advantage. I don't think that Donovan is going to have the balls to stay big with Adams and Kanter, and I don't think that they can guard the Spurs' three-point shooting. The Spurs have to get more three-pointers up as well. They're just not taking enough of those. They shot a decent percentage tonight, but, you know, 13, 14 shots in the modern NBA, you cannot be efficient shooting that many threes and shooting so many from mid-range. They got to really open things up, play more of the beautiful game, get some more assists, and that's a way that I would do it, especially against, you know, once they go to that Adams and Kanter front court. And I think that they, you know, that kind of push, like, they don't, the Spurs are not sort of new age enough in their normal incarnation to make them pay for that. You know, I think most teams, you just have a shooter at the four who can shoot threes. You can't play that Adams and Kanter lineup.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And another nuance that the Spurs just haven't used enough is that part of the reason I love Danny Green is that he is a player who can defend the point of attack. He can defend point guards. And of course, Kawhi can too. But he can't run an offense. So for most teams, that's a limitation because a vast majority of the guys who can be a primary ball handler are point guard size. So then you have to deal with those issues. The San Antonio Spurs have a guy capable of running the offense who is not point guard size, and that man is Manu Ginobili. If they play Green and Manu together more often and just give Manu that other assignment, gives them a little bit more size, gives them a little bit more guile. I'm not saying, you know, make it the starting lineup or anything, but just give it a shot to see if it works.
The other thing you can do too, if you go small, I mean, you're probably going to have to put Manu on Kanter is probably what you're going to do. Or you're going to have Manu having to guard one of Russ or, I mean, I guess maybe what you could do is you have Parker on Russ and then Kawhi on KD or actually probably Green on KD. And then you just have Kawhi guarding Kanter. You know, it's going to be, it might be ugly, but if they try and post up Kanter, you can just double him. You know, he's not a good enough passer, especially when you have more speed on the floor. Hopefully you can fly around a little bit with that unit. You know, don't play it all the time. I'm not saying that, but I think that you can really mess up that lineup and, you know, maybe they'll go back to Ibaka and that'll work too. But I think that what they've been doing against that lineup is not working. The other thing, I mentioned it already, give all of Slomo's minutes to Danny Green. Just take him out of the rotation completely. And if you do play anyone, just play Jonathan Simmons for like 3 minutes, just, you know, because, you know, he can at least like avoid screwing up defensively, you know, and at least provide like a little bit of athleticism where you're not just going to get destroyed. And I mean, at least, you know, even Jonathan Simmons can at least make an open three on occasion. He's been out of the rotation so long, I don't expect them to do that. But I mean, it's going to take a Herculean effort to win in Oklahoma City for game six. The Spurs now have to do what the Clippers did to them last year, which was be up 3-2. After a great road win in a classic game five, and then win on the road like the Clippers did to them last year. They can do it, but it's going to be real hard.
Another thing that Billy Donovan deserves credit for is that he tried Cameron Payne. It didn't work. So Cameron Payne didn't play. Randy Foy played those minutes, and those opportunities, and this is also true with the Waiters kind of usage issue, is that playing Westbrook and Durant more minutes, it gives you more flexibility because you have creators on the floor all the time, and you have two of them on the floor so much more, and I think that fits really well with Randy Foy.
Foy didn't do anything in this game, but he also didn't screw up, and that was the biggest problem with some of their bench units with Payne, is he was just throwing the ball away, you know, and you know, making a few mistakes defensively, but the biggest problem is he's just throwing it away, and so just even avoiding that was enough to really kind of put their bench units into the green. Is it the green or the black? I guess I'll say the green, but nonetheless, so I thought that was good. I mean, I still think that they could have done a better job to develop Payne, but it's too late now. He obviously was deer in the headlights in terms of turning the ball over, and so you just got to go back to Foy, and I might even give Foy some time over Robertson as well, as just to get another shooter on the floor when you don't necessarily have to match him up. And I guess the other big thing that's been so huge for Oklahoma City with that Adams and Kanter lineup is there's no way you can play Robertson and Kanter and Adams together all at the same time, because you're just really going to have no spacing. You know, they with Ibaka, at least they have some spacing with Robertson on the floor. So that has meant that KD has had to guard Kawhi. And they didn't want to do that because, you know, it's KD. He's got this huge offensive load. But he's done it. And to his credit, he has been really a lockdown guy on Kawhi. And when Kawhi has scored, it's been really, really tough shots. So that ability for KD to be a two-way guy in this series really opens up so much that you now don't have to have a complete sinkhole on the floor next to him.
And it's amazing how different these matchups will all look, whoever, assuming the Warriors advance, whoever faces them. Because a lot of these competitive advantages and disadvantages that we've been talking about are completely different against Golden State.
Yeah, we'll talk a little news here. The first one is, of course, that Curry won the MVP. He was the first unanimous vote getter ever. We were at the press conference today. You just have any thoughts on him as the MVP or the press conference or anything like that?
The unanimity of it is remarkable in the sense that when I think there were 131 votes, technically 130 and then a fan vote, you just assume that somebody's gonna do something like vote for their guy, because yeah. As one of both of our biggest beefs with the voting process is that a lot of people who are employed by NBA teams have votes. And that just...
Yeah, that's basically like the local announcers and radio announcers, for example.
Right, and so you just think somebody's going to screw it up by being a homer or whatever, and nobody did. And I personally believe that making ballots public by having it by their name has really helped that.
Yeah, I think that's helped. I think just the fact that there's more information available now, and that can lead to groupthink in our society and in basketball, but it also can lead to when something is right, it's right. And, you know, Curry had a historic season this year, maybe the best season in NBA history by anyone ever. And I think, you know, he deserved to be the unanimous MVP. There have been some who've deserved to be unanimous MVP before. Certainly LeBron James in 2013 did. You know, I think there was one vote. I can't remember whether that was
for
Melo or not at that point. Oh, yeah. Was that some, like, New York person or something?
I believe so.
Yeah. You know, that was ridiculous, right? Like, there's just no way that there are reasonable minds can disagree. Certainly, that was the case last year. But I do not think that reasonable minds could disagree on this one. And while, you know, tyranny of the majority or whatever of I'm probably butchering Tocqueville's theories there, but to say that there's a lot of pressure on people, that can be bad maybe, but I think in this case it was good that it was public, and whether it was the public shaming or whether it was just, hey, there's more information available now, people can watch other teams more, you know, you're not limited to seeing guys, you know, two or three times a year, they're on TV a lot. The Warriors went 73-9. I mean, that's a big part of it too. So it was good. Did anything interesting come out of the press conference for you?
Not really. I thought that last year's was a lot more emotional from him because it's a much bigger moment to win your first one than your second one, because, you know, I'm sure it was something that they never really saw coming. I thought Kerr's anecdote about the first time he met Curry's mom, Sonia Curry, asked him whether he thought Steph could make it in the league. I thought that was kind of amazing because she, you know, I'm not...
Yeah, when he was a sophomore in college.
When he was a sophomore in college. And that's not in any way a criticism of Sonia Curry. It's just amazing to see how that's happened. And something that you and I have discussed a lot and I think is underappreciated, I'm probably going to write about this tomorrow, is that Stephen Curry has improved more as a professional than any player I can think of. But it's just, it's incredible how much better he's gotten. And we talked about how he could get most improved player this year. But from day one, which happened to be the first game I covered as a Warriors writer, to that point was incredible as well.
Let's get some news. We can start with Dave Yeager, now hired in Sacramento, a four-year, $16 million deal, team option on the last year. Great deal for him. He doubles his salary. There was also some reporting out of Memphis from Chris Harrington that still shed a little bit more light on what some of the problems were there, and that their kind of thinking was, you know, we don't want to try and trade him because we would, you know, we're going to get a second round pick. He has 1 year remaining on his contract, although you can't actually trade a coach contract. You're just letting him out of the contract to let him sign with someone else. But nonetheless, that we don't want to deal with him in the last year of his contract. We don't want to give him an extension yet. He's kind of been agitating. He had these weird comments, you know, about not being involved in the draft and blah, blah, blah. So let's just fire him now. You know, yeah, we might have gotten a second round or something, but it's better to just be in the market now. And it could also be the case that they saw Frank Vogel get fired and is like, hey, maybe we should go try and hire that guy instead. And for the Kings as well, they drew out their process for a while and then they moved instantly. You'd have to imagine that there is at least, you know, some back channel discussions, not directly with Yeager perhaps, but no, let it be known that the Kings would have some great interest. And I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with that to me. because, you know, it sets up two parties who wanted to be together, the Kings and Jaeger. And as we talked about, he was a pretty good fit there, I think, in terms of, you know, what he brings defensively. Hopefully he can kind of have a little bit less drama with the front office. I'm sure Vlade Divac and Vivek Ranadive would say the same thing about themselves, and maybe this can be a new day in Sacramento. Probably not, but maybe.
Yeah, I think it's a reasonable best-case scenario for Sacramento. They got a guy who I think has been a good coach. Whether he's, you know, a great coach is probably open to interpretation now, but good is a whole lot better than they've had, and I think the personalities have a possibility of meshing. Also, it's this crazy thing with Jaeger's contract that he's getting double the money per year, but he's still getting almost a little over half of what Scott Brooks is getting.
Yeah, and as I said, I thought that Jaeger is probably a better coach than Scott Brooks from what we've seen. But Brooks has a better resume just in terms of wins and losses, obviously, and maybe relationships as well. More Kings news. Divac was asked about potentially trading DeMarcus Cousins, and he said he is not going to be traded this year for sure. I think maybe at the trade deadline you revisit that, but if you're hiring Jaeger, you got to give it one more chance with Cousins, see what you can bring in this summer, where they will have, you know, over $20 million in cap room, but they also will, you know, have to use some of it to re-sign Rajon Rondo if that's what they choose to do. But yeah, I think that seeing whether Dave Jaeger can get this team to defend, if you can get some more role players, rebuild the bench again. And then if it doesn't work out, you got to move him at the trade deadline, though, because otherwise, if you get into the summer where there's only 1 year left on his contract, then you're not going to get anything for him. If the other team, you know, at least in a relative sense, if the other team can get two playoffs out of the guy, then his value, I think, can go up a little bit higher. Injury news, what we got there?
Kemba Walker had meniscus surgery. It was the third time he's had meniscus surgery on his left knee. And whenever a guy has that many surgeries on the same body part, I get concerned.
Yeah, the same thing, same situation that Eric Bledsoe is in. It sounds like this is not a repair. I don't think a timetable was released yet. Repair would be, you know, putting him kind of almost in danger of not starting next season. This sounds like, again, more of a sort of, you know, another cleanup type of thing. But he's, you know, he's got to be running low on meniscus now at this point. I think he tweaked it in game one against Miami. I think it was the same knee. And that might explain kind of why he was very up and down during that playoff series. Like, you remember in that the game five, for example, in Miami, he was terrible. And then he was good in game six at home. He was good in game four at home. You know, maybe even to the extent of just being at home, you're able to get better treatment than you are on the road. It could be something as simple as that. But, you know, some days I'm sure it was feeling good, and other days it wasn't. And then another injury alert for another guy who's had a chronic problem. Devin Harris had surgery on his big toe, I think his left big toe. I think that's the same one that he has had surgery on many times before, the one that caused his three-year contract to be voided a couple of years ago with the Mavs. And so I think he's still under contract with them. Is that right?
Yes, I believe he is. And so, yeah, it was his left. I also like that it said left great toe. I think that's a lot cooler than big toe. And left thumb, so he's going to be all right for a little while.
Oh, man. How long? I mean, did you just like have that in your notes and you're just
thought of it about 30 seconds before, and that's actually an Arrested Development reference for those of you who watch that show, which is one of my favorites of all time.
Oh man! All right, we had one more piece of news. It's not really that important. We got to just end on that one. You got anything to plug before we depart?
Well, yeah. So I had my analysis of Game 4 of the Warriors series, and I actually tailored it to not Stephen Curry because I'm going to write on Steph today, and then I will have a new Real Jam Radio podcast out tomorrow with a special guest.
Yeah, very special. I happen to know who the identity of that is. But all right, that's awesome. Follow me on Twitter at NateDunganNBA. Leaving us an iTunes review or rating, always very much appreciated as well. And we will be back probably tomorrow night, depending on what happens in these game fives. And we'll be pretty late because we're going to be at that Warriors Portland game. And also start getting into some off-season previews as well. I think probably what we'll do is when these teams get eliminated, we can start doing them. That'll be a good way to kind of, you know, get into the series.
Agreed.
All right, that'll do it. We'll talk to you all tomorrow night.